We're talking about a tiny home village to help homeless veterans. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kemp. Thanks for being here. Wisconsin has about 4,900 people experiencing homelessness on any given day, and that's according to federal data. There are more than 300 Wisconsin veterans who do not have a place to live. And now a new tiny home village in Milwaukee is getting off the ground. It would provide a place to live in the transition to permanent housing. Have you seen tiny homes? Do you work with the homeless or economically disadvantaged people? What have you learned? What does the journey to stability look like? We're at 800-642-1234. Fiona Murphy is Development Director for Veterans Outreach of Wisconsin. The organization is expanding its Tiny Home Village program for homeless veterans. Fiona, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be able to talk about this with you.
Well, let's look at what's happened to Racine. The Racine Tiny Home Village's success has been really part of the motivation for what's going on in Milwaukee. Tell us about what happened in 2017 in Racine.
Well, 2017 was a pretty big year, not only for veterans experiencing homelessness here, but for our community, for our city and our county, because this really was the product of an entire community working together. We decided to take the food pantry that we had been operating for veterans experiencing homelessness. That was serving almost 400 veterans and including their family members, almost 2,000 veterans who were here in our immediate local area and were not accessing some of the other resources available for food insecurity. And we were noticing a lot of these people had no place to go. Winter was coming again, and Jeff Gustin, our executive director, said, you know, we need to find a way to actually house people who don't have anywhere to go during the year. So we called the then mayor, John Dickert, and said, you know, can you come on by the food pantry? We'd like to show you an idea. And Mayor Dickert immediately, to his credit, called up his the head of building development here in Racine and said, we're going to find a way to do this. I need our city to start working on ordinances. We're going to build a tiny home village. And that was February of 2016. And by November of 2016, our city council unanimously passed the ordinance. We had the land purchased, and our community had gotten together and built 15 tiny homes. So we were able to welcome our first residents in November of 2017. And in the less than 2 years since then, we've already successfully graduated 8 of our residents to permanent housing.
And when you say graduate, so these are people who had lived in the tiny homes and now have permanent housing elsewhere?
Correct. They have permanent housing, savings accounts. They've improved their credit scores. One of our former residents just bought a car. They're working. They are restored, I would say. Definitely restored to the path for exciting things ahead.
Help us understand what tiny homes look like, what they are.
Okay, and you know, and to start, I'll make a distinction here because there's going to be a size difference in our tiny homes between what we have here in Racine and what we have in Milwaukee. So in Racine, our tiny homes are about 120 square feet. We have 15 of them placed there, not on wheels, which is an important distinction for other people who in other communities have expressed interest in replicating the project. When you don't put wheels on the home, it makes it a little simpler to get an ordinance for this type of thing. And they're beautiful. You walk inside, they have, you know, a leather couch. The other than our handicapped accessible units where the bed is lower down, the bed is up in a loft. There are counters. There's a television, a computer desk area, a little refrigerator, a microwave, a Keurig coffee maker. Here in Racine, one of the differences is we do not utilize plumbing inside the units. We have it in a central community center. Our planned development in Milwaukee will actually have houses that are about twice the size, about 240 square feet, and there will be some plumbing in those units, but also the majority will be accessed in a community center. And that's done very intentionally. Veteran homelessness has a specific type of trauma that's usually associated with it. Tiny homes really fulfill the need for independence, privacy. One of the things a lot of our residents have said is one of the reasons that they didn't access other types of more traditional transitional housing, or did live in there and kind of fell out the back of it unsuccessfully. They didn't like long hallways and noises on either side or above them. So it was very important for us that we give that sense of their own home and
privacy.
Privacy. Yeah. Yet it is so important for trauma recovery, for connection, for human beings to connect with one another. So the community center serves as this fantastic way where on their own time each day, they have 24 hours, 7 days a week access to it. They are able to go in. There are leather couches, a beautiful kitchen, pool table, computer bank, and shower facilities, laundry facilities. And they're able to kind of just use that as an extension of their tiny home, but on their own schedule.
We're talking with Fiona Murphy. She's Director of Development for Veterans Outreach of Wisconsin, and the organization is expanding its Tiny Home Village program for homeless veterans, first in Racine, now to Milwaukee. We're learning what these homes look like. You can join in 800-642-1234. Have you seen tiny homes? What questions do you have about them? Do you think they'd make good transitional housing for the homeless? Are you a veteran? What challenges have you faced? Join in at 800-642-1234. Fiona, it sounds like you've seen the model in Racine, and now you're making some tweaks and changes to how you go about this in Milwaukee, one being a little bit larger footprint for these homes. Why is that?
Well, you know, one of the things is you had mentioned at the start of the show the figure, you know, about 300 homeless people a day in Wisconsin. That figure is actually about 300 a day in Milwaukee. In a year in Milwaukee, there are usually four times that many homeless for at least a bit of time, and an additional about 5,000 to 6,000 local veterans in Milwaukee who are classified as being at risk. So for one reason, we have a lot more people to try and serve and get housing for, and we will be offering in Milwaukee the ability for married couples who are in the service to live here instead of the single resident status that we have down here. So the way that the development would look in Milwaukee is, you know, similar kind of collections, almost like mini villages within the village that have two homes that are connected by a covered porch. Outdoor recreation and outdoor relaxation is a really big part of self-care and wellness. So we want to extend that into a porch, a private porch kind of area between two homes.
How does the tiny home concept then work as a step to stability and independence for permanent housing elsewhere?
Okay, well, I'd also like to classify this as we really believe that we have, when it's executed responsibly, a great solution for veteran homelessness, but we don't want to go out saying that we have a solution for all homelessness. You know, I think we know what works for veterans and that specific kind of trauma. What we do here is when a resident comes in and occupies a tiny home, we have a fantastic resident coordinator who is located here in the complex, and she sits down with them, and, you know, it's a very individual recipe that each person needs, and says, you know, what are your goals? Where would you like to see yourself? Where are you coming in with challenges? And kind of designs a menu of resources that are available for that individual.
They kind of look at what those next steps will be in their personal life. We're talking with Fiona Murphy. She is our guide. She's with Veterans Outreach of Wisconsin. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about tiny home villages as a way to address homelessness among veterans. It is the morning show. I'm Kedar Chirkent. In 2017, Veterans Outreach of Wisconsin opened a model tiny housing village in Racine. Now they're expanding the concept to Milwaukee, where dozens could be built. Do you work with the homeless or the economically disadvantaged? What have you learned? What does the journey to stability look like? And what do you think of tiny home villages as a step toward permanent housing? Join in at 800-642-1234. We're with Fiona Murphy. She's Development Director with Veterans Outreach of Wisconsin. Let's go to the phones now. Mary joining us from Madison. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I was listening to this program, and congratulations. It brought me tears in my eyes because I think the vets deserve it, what they have to go through fighting, especially when the young guys, they're 18 years old, going in there and seeing all the terrible stuff, and you got these tiny homes. I think it's wonderful. And I was thinking about it while I was waiting, and I was just wondering, how do they get around? Maybe they should have bicycles, or do they take the bus to find jobs or things like that? But congratulations.
Mary, thank you so much for the call. Fiona, what is transportation like around these villages, and how do veterans get around?
Well, we do have bicycles. We also have bus passes that we're able to give our residents, and many of our residents also have vehicles. Some didn't have vehicles when they arrived, but part of the program here is, you know, the costs are all covered, and we're privately funded. It's our community that funds us. We don't take federal money. This doesn't cost the taxpayers anything. We're privately funded. So we have donated bus passes, but residents come in, and as part of building up their path forward, they set goals. And for many residents, one of those is, you know, get a savings account so that when the time comes a year, you know, whether it's 9 months or a year and a half after they join us here to move into more permanent supported housing, they have a nice support behind them, a safety net. And buying a car is a big goal for a lot of our residents, and one that's been achieved. And in fact, one of the most beautiful things, when Mary said, you know, brings tears to her eyes, people here, you know, laugh every day, because I'm known for, there are at least four or five times a day, my hand goes up to my face and tears start coming down my face because so many beautiful things happen. But one of the best things was just this last week, one of our former residents came in, Mike, and he gave a car to one of the staff members who works the front desk. He had a vehicle through his church he'd been using. I think he upgraded, and he knew that our receptionist was relying upon her daughter's car to try to get to work every day. So he had like a 1992 car he still had the title for, and he walked in and he said, "Sandy, you helped me so much when I was here. I want to pay this forward." And, you know, things like that happen every day.
Wow. What a beautiful story. That is amazing. Let's bring in Eric now in Milwaukee. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
What is on your mind?
I just have a general question regarding construction. If someone didn't have the financial contribution, if there's a possible way for them to donate their time and free labor to help support the cause. And that's all I have. I'll listen. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for offering. And I'll tell you, that's what built our village here in Racine. We had it at our tiny home build. We would have such incredible diversity. We had, you know, a 78-year-old grandmother who had never held a hammer for the first time was out at one of our build days learning how to frame tiny homes. We had Eagle Scouts. We had church groups. We had school groups. We had biker clubs. We had a number of tradesmen. So what will be happening as we get closer to the actual construction? At the moment, we're going through the process with the city for all the ordinances and all the paperwork to go through. When we start the construction process, we will have on our website, which is vets
outreachwi.us, an online volunteer sign-up list. So people, we can kind of organize who'd love to just come and try building or who might have something, you know, a specific skill to donate. So you'll be able to kind of keep up with us there, or also Facebook. We're on Facebook at Veterans Outreach of Wisconsin. We post a lot every day of daily snapshots of what life is actually like here in our Racine Village. Kind of a lot of, it's kind of like my version of a family album, because that's really, this is family to us here now, and family to our residents, and family for our community to come in and have gotten to know our residents. So that's our family album. We also post specific needs that we might have. Just last week, I had just mentioned that one day, you know, the residents here had thought, gosh, it would be great one day to maybe have something like a horseshoe pitch in our field. And that afternoon, I had a young man, incredible young man, Eli, who's working on his Eagle Scout project, call and say, hey, would you mind, may I take that on as my Eagle Scout project? So he was by last night at the community meeting discussing design ideas with the residents. They're going to help him build it. And suddenly, you know, a week after just mentioning it, Eli, our soon-to-be Eagle Scout, is going to help us build a horseshoe pitch here. So we'll be keeping everybody updated on how to join in.
We're talking with Fiona Murphy. She's with Veterans Outreach of Wisconsin, and the organization is expanding its Tiny Home Village program for homeless veterans in Milwaukee. We're learning about the project now. You know, we've had conversations here, Fiona, about veterans issues, and anecdotally, we hear that veterans' benefits are unclear or they're hard to access. Do you see that as an issue for veterans who live in these tiny home villages?
Well, one of the first things that we do when they arrive is to reconnect them with their resources, but that is one of the primary reasons that they end up coming here in the first place. A lot of people don't realize that, you know, you can't get benefits if you don't have a permanent address. You know, it seems like such a simple thing, and yet that one hurdle alone can be catastrophic in starting the snowballing chain of events. A lot of other people are amazed to find out how many of the people who are homeless and sleeping rough, meaning sleeping on the streets. Like, you know, two of our last residents, for example, one of them had been sleeping behind the Bed Bath & Beyond here in town. Another resident had been sleeping for almost 4 years in the woods with his beautiful dog, Eva, in a tent, including during winter, for 4 years. And they had jobs. They were working full time. I think one of the common things that I hear when people take tours here of our village is, you know, they say, well, if I was walking past that gentleman or that woman on the street, I would have no idea they were homeless. And that's really the point. Veteran homelessness is right in front of us, and we don't even see it. Very often, our veterans, like I said, were working full-time jobs and still sleeping in doorways. So when they come here, you know, getting them connected with disability payments or introducing them to resources they deserve that they've served to have and didn't even know were available to them is one of the very first things that we do when they walk in the door.
Fiona, for communities that are thinking about this model and they're looking at site plans in their city, what is the Milwaukee site currently being used for? What type of tract of land do you need?
Well, it really depends upon how extensive your project is going to be. Currently, it's an empty tract of land up. It's at 6767 North 60th Street in Milwaukee. We had someone just come in the other day who had driven up from Florida, and they were driving around a little model tiny home on a trailer and visiting different tiny home communities throughout the country. And she said, you know, we have a very generous donor, and we'd like to start off with 50 homes. And I said, nope. you want to start off with no more than maybe 20 or 25 if you're doing this for the first time. We did this so intentionally because we want to we want to serve each individual best, and we didn't want to take on any new projects until we really believed we got the formula right. We presented this to the mayors across the country in 2017 at the U.S. Conference of Mayors in Miami, and afterwards we had a line of mayors saying, we want this, you know, all but taking out their checkbooks, can you build us homes and bring them to us? We said, thank you, but no, our responsibility, first and foremost, is to the village we've already built, the residents in it, and to our neighbors around that and our community. And once we know we've got that right, we'll be willing to expand. So we're only bumping up to these 48 homes now that we've spent a solid 2 years with measurable successes here in Racine.
Yeah, so you're trying to take this step by step, incrementally, and learn from each step, it sounds like. Well, Fiona, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. And, you know, and I would say to your listeners that we are down here in Racine. If you live in Milwaukee and you're curious about what this village is going to feel like up in Milwaukee, we are open during the week. I encourage you to go onto our website. That's outreachwi.us. See our phone number. Give us an email. You're welcome to come and tour. We can arrange a time for people to tour and walk around, see our community center, and get more of a sense of what it feels like to have a village like this in your neighborhood.
Fiona Murphy is Director of Development for Veterans Outreach of Wisconsin. The organization is expanding its tiny home village, as she said, in Milwaukee. To learn more about this program, go to wpr.org/mornings. Coming up, new research shows that pension systems with big unfunded liabilities may not be in much of a crisis as once thought. Talking about pensions after this news update, stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the state of public pensions here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Public pension plans fell short of their projected returns this year, and that could add to the problems that governments face in funding promised benefits to retired workers. State and local government pension plans are a big driver in our economy. They hold nearly $4 trillion in assets. So how are they doing? Is there really a pension crisis? Are you looking to retirement and concerned that your pension won't be fully funded at the level you anticipated decades ago? Join in at 800-642-1234. Louise Shaner is Policy Director for the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution, and she recently co-authored a 70-page report that examines how state and local government pensions are doing in America. Louise, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, it seems that governments are really behind the eight ball here with $1.2 trillion in unfunded liabilities for pensions. How worried should we be by this level of debt?
So I think that the way you talk about it as a level of debt is exactly the right way to think about it. So our study was looking at the sustainability of these plans. And so as you mentioned, the big focus that you hear about all the time is the fact that they're not fully funded. And so analyses that say, oh, my God, to get to fully funded, you're going to have to, you know, just make huge, massive changes in your pensions. And our point is that full funding is not necessary. It's not necessarily even the right metric. They basically have debt, just like the federal government has debt. So there's sort of pension debt. And what you need to do is just be able to maintain that debt, not let it explode. And so we focus on the question of whether or not these plans are sustainable in the sense that they'll be able to pay their benefits without going bankrupt. And if they can't, and if they're not sustainable, what changes have to be made? And what we find is plans are on average in the United States not sustainable, right? So they definitely are going to have to make changes, but the changes are rather modest relative to the kinds of other numbers that we often hear out there. So we find, you know, it depends on what you assume about your interest rate, which you just mentioned too, the rate of return. But under sort of a moderate assumption about an interest rate, they would have to increase contributions by about 4% of payroll, which is not nothing, but it's not some of the numbers you hear that are more like 20 or 25% of payroll on average.
So,
and that's for the U.S. on average.
Why do you see such a disparity? Because there's a headline out this morning that says America is facing a pension crisis. Retirees will pay the price if we don't act now. That's threatening.
Yes, it is. And so I think that it's not that we're saying that there's no issue. It's just that we think the word crisis is wrong. And again, it's about imagine. I think the best analogy is imagine if you said the United States has a debt equal to 75% of its GDP, which is like the federal government. And imagine if you said in 30 years, you better pay off that debt. Right. Well, then you'd have to make massive changes to taxes and spending. But if you say you don't have to pay off the debt, you just have to not let it keep going up and just pay the interest costs, then it's a lot more manageable of a problem. And that's kind of what we're saying for pensions, which is the goal shouldn't be to be fully funded. They've never been fully funded, especially using the kinds of rates of return interest rates that economists like to use. They've never been fully funded, and that's fine. They just have to make sure that they don't, you know, go belly up, and so that they can actually pay benefits. And so then they have to make some modest changes. The other thing that we found, and part of what's going on behind our results is this, is that pension plans have made a lot of changes over the last decade to actually put themselves in a better position. So they've raised contributions quite a bit, and we're saying, well, if you just keep that up, that's pretty good. They've also cut the COLA, so they have sort of hurt certain retirees by not giving them inflation.
What's COLA?
So a COLA is what happens once you retired and you have a benefit. If inflation goes up 2%, then your benefit might go up 2% so that real purchasing power of your benefit stays the same. And sort of some plans do that automatically. Some plans don't do it at all unless, you know, their legislature approves it. And they've made changes so that they've been less generous over the past decade. And so that's pulled back on some of the benefit costs. And they've also made reforms for new employees that are sort of coming in over time, right? Which is that in general, sort of an existing employee's pension is kind of protected. But a new hire, you can say, we have a pension reform, and now you've got to work an extra 5 years or your benefit's not quite as generous. And they've done quite a bit of that as well.
So we're seeing a bit less generous pensions, perhaps for the younger generations, for millennials.
We are seeing less generous pensions. And then one way to think about that, though, is, state and local government employees mostly still have defined benefit plans, which says if you work a certain number of years, you're going to get a benefit based on your average salary in the last few years. And it doesn't depend on the sort of the rate of return. It's just a fixed guarantee formula. Most people in the private sector don't have that anymore. They have defined contributions where the employer will put some money in an account for you.
And like a 401k.
Like a 401k or that kind of pension where you just have the money in the account. And if your account doesn't do well, then it's on you, right? Whereas in the defined benefit world, if the assets don't do well, it's on the employer. They still owe you sort of that the same amount of money. And so one of the things that's happened in sort of the macro economy, you know, globally over the past 20 years is interest rates have been coming down. And so it's those defined benefit plans have actually sort of just gotten more and more valuable. And so they've cut back a little bit, so it might not be that they've actually cut back. It's just that they haven't allowed them to rise as much, the value to rise as much as they would have. Right, so if I promise you a certain amount in 20 years and interest rates of return fall, that thing's really valuable.
We're talking with Louise Shaner. She's policy director for the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution. She recently co-authored a report on how local and state pensions are doing across America. You can join in 800-642-1234. Are you set to retire soon, but are worried your plan won't cut it? Why is that? What kind of job do you think Wisconsin has done with its pension system. What changes do you want to see in our state to make the pension system stronger? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Louise, the median U.S. public pension return 6.2% in the fiscal year that ended in June 30th. This is the weakest performance in 3 years. Are you worried at all with these new numbers out?
Well, so a lot of the conversation around pensions has been on what is assumed by the plan, the rate of return that they're going to get, versus what economists think they should be assuming, which is a much lower number. And that is a part of why people say, oh, they're in such bad shape, is because if you would say, you know, according to the plans, they're 70% funded, but really if you used a proper rate of return, lower number, they'd be like only 50% fully funded. So I sort of had brought up this issue about low interest rates and low rates of return. It is what economists expect to persist, right? So interest rates have fallen a lot. That's sort of on treasuries, but it sort of affects rates of return sort of throughout, sort of on equities, on all kinds of bonds. And so we do think interest rates are going to be lower. But we took those lower interest rates into account in our analysis. And one of the interesting things about lower interest rates is it also means that sort of trying to shore up your pension plan is sort of harder, right? So if you want to get the full funding, it's harder when interest rates are low for exactly that reason. But it also means that there's sort of less pressure to do it. You don't get that much for investing in sort of in your pension plan, for sort of shoring up your pension plan. And so one of the other points that I think is very, very important, and that's kind of behind this study, which is if state and local government says, oh, my God, my pension is in crisis, I'm going to divert all this money towards contributing to the pension, but interest rates are really low. And what they're doing is cutting things like education, support for poor families, health care for poor families, infrastructure. If they're cutting those things that are actually good investments in order to put money in their pension plan that may not be such a good investment, that is actually not the right thing to do for the fiscal health of the state as a whole. And so part of the reason to sort of, you know, not push so hard on the crisis thing is because they should really be thinking about, okay, what is the best investment for my state? And sometimes that's going to be spending money in certain places. That sounds like it's spending money, but evidence suggests that when you help poor families, that will actually pay for itself in the long run because the families will thrive and the people will get more education and crime will go down. There's like a lot of ways in which investing in your people really
has a return. Yeah,
exactly. And so that's the trade-off that they really have to think about.
Louise, let me ask you this. Have you seen state and local pensions recover from the market losses that we saw during the Great Recession? Have we seen full recovery from the Great Recession?
So, you know, that's a good question. I mean, they definitely have recovered. Whether or not they fully recovered is something I should know. but they've definitely recovered some, like all of us have. The stock market has recovered, or at least has until. And so I think that they have largely recovered. And also they've made these changes that are putting them on a better footing going forward. So I don't actually have the picture about whether or not they've recovered. So I'm not going to answer that question.
We're talking about the health and stability of state and local government pensions with Louise Shaner. She is policy director for the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy. That's at the Brookings Institution. And she recently co-authored a 70-page report that examines how public pensions are doing across America. Do you think governments are adequately funding their pension systems? How would you rate Wisconsin's pension system? Will you rely on a public pension in retirement? Do you watch it? How concerned are you with it? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at what the future holds for government pensions here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to Pew, Wisconsin is one of three states with the best funded pension plans in 2017, having paid 100% of contributions that actuaries had recommended. And as a result, retirement systems were nearly fully funded or had surplus funding while maintaining stable contributions. Illinois, on the other hand, was one of the states with the worst funded retirement systems in the country, in part because policymakers did not consistently set aside the amount there actuaries said was necessary to cover the cost of promised benefits to retirees. So how are you feeling about your pension? What questions do you have about how state and local governments fund them, how they work? We're at 800-642-1234. And Louise Shaner is Policy Director for the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution, and she stays with us. Let's go to the phones now with John joining us from Madison. Hi, John. Oh, and John isn't there. John is not there, but was wondering, John asked, isn't South Dakota and Wisconsin the only states that do have fully funded pensions that are not running out of money? Which really begs the question, how does Wisconsin stack up in its pension system?
So Wisconsin actually was not in our sample. We did not do a universe of pension plans. There's meant so many, and it's very data intensive, but I sort of looked at Wisconsin, and Wisconsin definitely is one of the ones that is close to, you know, in best financial shape. And one of the things that Wisconsin does is something that is, you know, I talked about sort of a defined benefit versus defined contribution. It sort of has some hybrid aspects of it, which is that sort of whether or not, so when the assets don't do well, the beneficiaries, I think, share in that sort of burden of it, in the sense that their benefits won't go up as much, or that they won't get a COLA if the assets don't do well, for example. And so Wisconsin definitely is one that has, that is in better shape. Now, we didn't do an analysis of sort of how do plans get to where they were, which is something we'd like to do in future work. How much of is it that, you know, policymakers just sort of were irresponsible, and how much of it is that there were economic shocks that made policymakers, you know, not to think that pension contributing to the pension made economic sense. Those are all plausible stories. And so I think that that is something we want to look at. But Wisconsin definitely is in much better shape than many other plans out there.
So which states should worry about the health of their pension system in what you studied?
Well, so, you know, what's interesting is the relationship between sort of how fully funded plans are and how much more they need to do isn't really one for one.
Okay.
So some plans, as you mentioned, Illinois, some of the Illinois plans are like at 40% funding only, but they have made major changes and they are contributing a lot already. And if they keep doing that, they'll actually be okay, whereas other plans have to do a lot. So in our sample, we didn't do every plan. Some of the plans that need to make the biggest changes are like the Missouri Teachers Plan, the Georgia Teachers Plan. It's kind of all over the place. So some New Jersey plans are in bad shape, and definitely some Illinois plans as well have to make some big changes. Whereas, you know, in order to just be sustainable, some plans actually can stop contributing as much as they've been contributing in recent years.
When you look and it sounds like it's hard to make apples to apples comparisons here across pensions, across state borders. But are there certain pension programs you see in the country that really set a standard for how you should approach pensions that are doing a good job at sustainability over the long haul?
So certainly a plan that's fully funded is going to be doing a good job at sustainability. And we didn't really answer the question of what sort of the optimal pension policy is, because remember that you can be doing a good job because you don't provide very good pensions for your employees. That might be look like a good choice from a sort of financial standpoint.
Oh, because they're really fiscally very conservative.
Yeah, exactly. You might say, you know, so they have no problem, but they also like don't, you know, treat their employees well, and perhaps they don't get the best employees coming into government, or perhaps, is, you know, there's other issues about not, you know, treating your workforce well. And so I think that question isn't only about like, you know, oh, the plans are in good shape. That's necessarily that they made good choices. And so I think it's a harder question overall, which is, you know, what does your compensation package look like for your employees? Is it a reasonable compensation package? And how are you financing it? And sort of, again, as I said before, what is that marginal cost of funds for you? Where are you putting your money? If you're not putting it into your pension, what are you putting it into? If you're investing in your, you know, in your community, maybe that's a good choice as well. So I think it's hard to go from like, oh, pension is in it looks in good shape. That's sort of the right way to approach pensions. And it's a whole question that we actually would like to address, sort of how do we think about what that looks like, the optimal one? We didn't do that. We really just said, let's evaluate the financial condition of the plans as they stand and just sort of say what the numbers are without saying, oh, here's what we think they should all do.
And I think we should take a moment here to step back and realize that according to the Federal Reserve, a quarter of non-retired Americans have no retirement savings
exactly.
or a pension as of last year. So, you know, even having a pension is something.
Exactly. And that's what I was saying. It's like you want to think about both sides of it, which is providing a reasonable standard of living for your employees in retirement is a good thing, right? And so you've got to think about how you finance that, but not necessarily say, well, let's just cut that back and cut that back and cut that back because we can't afford it.
So if a city or a state is struggling with a lot of debt, how much of a priority should funding their pension system be as opposed to funding roads or funding schools?
Exactly. So I think that when you have opportunities to invest in your community that are likely to yield good returns, you know, that probably should be a priority. That if what you do is say, oh, I've got to put my pension into good shape and I'm going to cut services and I'm going to make this a less attractive place to live and then people aren't going to stay, like you can get into that downward spiral, right? So there is a big question on plans, on places where the pension's in trouble and, you know, public services aren't very good. It's hard to know what to do, right? Because it's just you do get into this kind of downward spiral if you try to shore up too much stuff. And so I think, you know, that's another question is what do some of these places who are in big trouble do? Because it's almost no matter what they do, it makes the situation worse. It's hard to figure a way out.
We're talking with Louise Shaner. She's Policy Director for the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution, and we're looking at the state of pensions in America. Louise, you had mentioned in your study there are $4 trillion of assets in pensions today. That is a lot of money in pensions. Do you see pensions as a way forward for governments in the future, decades from now?
I mean, I think they can maintain, that's what our study shows. Like, they don't have to make huge changes in order to maintain sustainability, right? They have to make some changes, but it's not as if they're all gonna go by the wayside. So I think there has been this push to move towards a little bit more of a defined contribution, aspect to it. And I, you know, whether or not that's a good idea or not, I'm not actually sure. Again, because the protection to the employees of a defined benefit plan is quite valuable. But I think, yeah, I think that as an institution, they probably will maintain themselves and can. We'll have to make some modest changes on average. And some plans won't, right? There's lots, some plans are just going to have a big problem. But on average, I think that the institution of state and local government pensions is here to stay.
So as we start to wrap up, what are you watching for with pensions? What else needs to be studied? Because you did a lot of math in your 70-page report as you looked at pensions across America.
Well, there's a lot more that we want to do, actually. So as I said, we want to think about what plans should do, how to think about the optimal strategy for different plans and different kind of financial conditions. We also do want to address some of those questions I talked about before, which is, you know, some people think, oh, the plan's in bad shape. That's because the government is irresponsible. And we're not sure that's the case. We kind of want to figure out how did the plans that are in bad shape get there, right? Mm. You know, what were the factors? We want to look at for the places that have really boosted their contributions, what trade-offs did they make, right? Where did that money come from? Did they cut investment in kids, you know, did they, you know, sort of trying to understand sort of the state and local financial system.
What was the give and take? Yeah.
Exactly. I think we don't really know that.
Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Louise Shaner is Policy Director for the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution. You can find a link to her report on pensions on the Morning Show page at WPR.org. Coming up, we learn about sudden lucidity among dementia patients at the end of life. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.